convened. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Afternoon. We're delighted to welcome this afternoon 7th and 8th graders from Holy Cross Lutheran in Madison. Would they stand, please? Thank you. You may be seated. Do you have information about the case you're about to hear? You do. That's good. Makes it easier to understand the oral arguments. We've met you. I'd like to introduce the court to you all. Starting on my far left is Justice Diane Sykes. Seated next to her is Justice Patrick Crooks. To my immediate left is Justice John Wilcox. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice William Babich, and to his right, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and on the far right, Justice David Prosser. With those introductions made, I'll now call the last case for today, 01-1476 CR, State versus Patricia Weed. Representing Ms. Weed is T. Christopher Kelly. Mr. Kelly.
May it please the Court, my name is Chris Kelly. I represent Patricia Weed in this appeal from a judgment of conviction of the crime of first-degree intentional homicide. This case comes before the Court to review a per curiam unpublished Court of Appeals decision which affirmed that conviction. I hope in the time that I have today I'll be able to address three of the crucial issues that we raised in this case. First, whether Ms. Weed's constitutional right to confront a witness was violated when out-of-court statements were introduced against her at her trial, and whether, in fact, those out-of-court statements were inadmissible hearsay. The Court of Appeals did not address that issue. Secondly, whether, if there was a constitutional error, the error was harmless. The Court of Appeals held that it was, but we believe that the Court of Appeals used an incorrect standard of harmless error in arriving at that conclusion. And finally, whether Ms. Weed validly waived her right to testify given that she did not personally and expressly do so at the time of trial. The facts are pretty simple in terms of the appellate issues that we're raising today. Very briefly, in September of 1998, Ms. Weed dialed 911. She reported to the dispatcher that she had shot her husband, that he was laying on the floor, and asked the dispatcher to send someone. When the deputies from the county sheriff's department arrived, they had Ms. Weed exit her residence. They put her down on the ground. She told the first deputy that she asked the first deputy to go check on her husband. The deputy did. When they first looked at her husband, they saw only a little bit of blood. There were no obviously visible wounds except for one on his arm. When they checked in more detail, they discovered that he was deceased. One of the deputies then told Ms. Weed that her husband was dead. She reacted to that by covering her face with her hands as if she were weeping. Detectives started talking to her shortly after that. She told the first detective, "I didn't mean to hurt him." She was interrogated after that for some length of time, gave a statement that was partially recorded at least, and continually throughout her interview said she didn't mean to hurt her husband. She only wanted to scare him. She had no recollection of actually firing the gun. The other piece of evidence that I think is very important is that Fred and Christopher Feuerbringer testified during the course of the trial that about 3 days before this shooting, they were having a get-together with the Weeds, and that Michael Weed, Patricia's husband, after a heated argument with Patricia, made a comment about unloading the gun, presumably the gun with which Patricia shot her husband 3 days later. And it is that conversation that we view as violating Ms. Weed's right to confront a witness. That conversation obviously was, or rather the statement made by the declarant, Michael Weed, was obviously made out of court, so we have an out-of-court declaration. The usual test for whether an out-of-court declaration, in other words, one made by somebody who isn't in court subject to cross-examination, whether that kind of a declaration is admissible under the Confrontation Clause is whether the statement is admitted pursuant to a firmly rooted hearsay exception. The State in this case has not argued that the exception upon which the trial court relied, the exception for statements of recent perception, is a firmly rooted hearsay exception. And I don't think there is any basis for making that argument. It is not an exception that has enjoyed widespread acceptance, nor is it one that has been a part of the common law, and certainly hasn't been a part of the law of evidence in Wisconsin for a long time. Since it isn't a firmly rooted hearsay exception, the State has an uphill battle arguing that the admission of that statement doesn't violate the Confrontation Clause. We've been told by the United States Supreme Court that there is a weighty presumption against the admission of uncross-examined evidence, and that for evidence that doesn't meet a firmly rooted hearsay exception to be admissible under the Confrontation Clause, it must have particularized guarantees of trustworthiness. The Supreme Court told us in Idaho against Wright that those guarantees of trustworthiness must arise out of the circumstances under which the statement was made. In other words, you can't look at other evidence in the case to kind of corroborate this evidence or to bolster its reliability. The circumstances themselves have to be reliable. And the court in Idaho against Wright said that for evidence which is uncross-examined to be admitted, it must be inherently trustworthy. The purpose of the Confrontation Clause is to assure that evidence not only is given under oath, but is subjected to cross-examination so that the jury can judge the demeanor or evaluate the demeanor of the witness as the witness is testifying. Obviously, Michael Weed's statement that he had unloaded the gun was not subjected to cross-examination, and we do not believe that it is such an inherently trustworthy statement that it can be admitted without violating the Confrontation Clause. Confrontation is designed to assure that the only evidence which is uncross-examined that comes before a jury is evidence that is so reliable that cross-examination really wouldn't matter, and that isn't the case here. The circumstances in this case show that Michael's statement was inherently untrustworthy, not that it was trustworthy. The FOIA bringers testified that Michael gave or made this statement to them after he had been drinking, after he had been engaged in what Fred FOIA bringer described as an escalating argument, after Mr. FOIA bringer's wife, Patricia, had just accused him of adultery and exposed him to his friends as an adulterer, after Patricia had promised to make him, quote, the poorest asshole in Portage, end quote. Under those circumstances, it cannot be said that the response that Michael made to those statements and that argument and those circumstances, it cannot be stated that what Michael said next was inherently trustworthy. I think what we all know, as a matter of common experience, is that people who are involved in heated arguments often say things that aren't true, that aren't trustworthy, that are designed to retaliate, that are designed to get even, that are designed to save face, but not things that, by virtue of the circumstances, you can say are entirely believable, so that there's no point in cross-examining, because cross-examination wouldn't change the fact that this is inherently reliable.
Okay,
testimony.
So let's assume you have convinced me that this was hearsay, should not have been admitted under what is it, 908045?
Correct, sub 2.
Okay, let's assume that, sub 2. So what? It's an error?
It is an error.
How does it get to confrontation, number one? And number two, why isn't it harmless?
It gets to confrontation because since the statement is not reliable and does not come in pursuant to a firmly rooted hearsay exception, the statement violates the confrontation clause. Now, how the court gets
but
there.
But the defendant never, defendant's counsel never objected on grounds of confrontation, just on hearsay.
That's correct. And we have argued that counsel was ineffective for failing to do so.
So is every violation of the hearsay rule a confrontation issue in criminal law?
I have been trying to think of a situation in which inadmissible hearsay would not also violate the confrontation clause, and I can't think of one. The point of the hearsay rules is to, for the most part, exclude out-of-court statements that aren't subject to cross-examination simply because the law doesn't view them as reliable. Exceptions to the hearsay rule exist when the circumstances suggest that the statement is reliable, even though it was given out of court.
They don't view them as reliable because they're not subject to cross-examination.
True. They're viewed as reliable because of the surrounding circumstances,
right.
Because it's an excited utterance or whatever.
All right. So even if we concede that there's a violation of hearsay is a violation of confrontation, not every confrontation constitutes grounds for reversal.
That is correct, Your Honor. And that brings us to the harmless error test. The harmless error test that
Well, we get there. What about the final, that is the last clause on hearsay exceptions, you know, any other reason that you should admit the hearsay? That's not quite what it says, but
Maybe
it would fit under the final clause under
The residual exception?
Yeah, right, residual exception. Thank you.
The residual, sure. The residual exception, the case law has told us, isn't a catch-all. It is designed to allow the admission of those statements that are so self-evidently reliable that they are comparable to the other exceptions to the hearsay rule. So they should be comparable to an excited utterance, comparable to a certified copy of a government record or something like that. For the same reasons that Michael Weed's statement to the FOIA bringers wasn't reliable enough to satisfy the confrontation clause, it's also not reliable enough to satisfy the residual exception. Again, you have to look at the circumstances, and we still have Michael in the course of a heated argument who has been insulted by his wife, who has been exposed by an adulterer to his friends, and who then, behind her back, after his wife leaves his presence, makes an insulting comment about her, saying he unloaded the gun, suggesting that she was so so deranged or so loose in her thinking or so dangerous that she couldn't be trusted with a loaded gun. Those aren't the kinds of circumstances that satisfy the residual exception to the hearsay clause, because again, there's nothing about those circumstances that makes what he said so reliable that it should come in to a jury as if it is accepted truth.
Suppose Michael had said to Fred Furbringer, I'm afraid Patricia's going to try to kill me. Same setting. Is that a different statement in any way?
It isn't a statement that expresses a fact. It expresses a fear, so I'm not sure that it meets the definition of hearsay.
It may not be this recently perceived, but what about an excited utterance?
Again, I'm not sure it's hearsay at all, because I'm not sure that a declaration about how somebody feels is hearsay, or what they fear
is hearsay.
Okay,
suppose Michael had said, Patricia has threatened to kill me.
That, I think, would be hearsay. Whether it would meet an exception to the hearsay rule, I think, would depend upon the circumstances again.
Well, exactly the same circumstances here. They've had an argument. They've been drinking. There is a relationship between Michael and Fred. And after Patricia's taken out, Michael turns to Fred and says, Patricia has threatened to kill me.
Under the same circumstances, I don't think there's a difference between the two statements. It continues to be an unreliable statement because of the circumstances. We still have a heated argument. We still have Michael having been belittled publicly by his wife. We still have Michael having an incentive to say something nasty about his wife. I don't think that there are indicia of reliability connected to that statement. In fact, it's the kind of statement you might expect an angry husband who has been drinking and has been exposed as an adulterer to say, even if it's not true. So, no, I don't think that it would be admissible either under the hearsay exceptions or the confrontation clause.
Under the under 908.045, a statement can come in if it is not in contemplation of pending or anticipated litigation in which the declarant was interested. Now, it strikes me that one could argue, tell me what you think of this argument, that in fact Michael was interested in potential litigation between him and his wife, a divorce suit.
That's certainly possible. And that's one of the reasons that it wasn't admissible under 908.045 sub 2, because the state didn't lay the foundation. They didn't lay the foundation that he made the statement in good faith. A part of that analysis goes to what you suggested, Justice Bablich, that it wasn't made in contemplation of pending or imminent litigation. They didn't lay the foundation that Michael was describing something that had recently occurred. They didn't lay the foundation that he had a clear recollection at the time that he was talking. None of that foundation was laid, and those are all reasons why this statement wasn't admissible under 908.045 sub 2.
If Mr. Kelly, I assume that although the court's interested in the hearsay, that perhaps the court may have taken this case because of either the harmless error or the waiver of a constitutional right to testify, or both.
Sure.
So unless there are further questions on this, maybe you should move on.
I will move on to harmless error.
Could I ask one more question?
Sure.
I think you outlined several factors of why you thought the statement was unreliable.
Yes.
What is drinking? There was an argument, and he was angry because he had just been humiliated. Was there anything else?
The fact of the humiliation, the fact that she made disparaging comments about making him poor, and the fact that he said this behind her back. In other words, I think he at that point was outside. There were grilling or cooking outside. She came outside, asked for the car keys. He refused to give them to her.
Which one of those is the most important?
I'm sorry?
Which one of those is the most important?
It's hard to say because they all sort of coalesce to make his statement unreliable, but I think probably the most important thing is his angry state of mind. People who are in an angry state of mind, who have been in an angry state of mind because they're humiliated, are likely to retaliate, not to say things that are assuredly truthful. Turning then to whether the error was harmless, we know from the United States Supreme Court that the test for federal constitutional error is that an error should result in reversal unless it is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And that means that it must be clear beyond a reasonable doubt that the error did not contribute to the verdict. And the Supreme Court in Brecht against Abrahamson said that state courts must use the Chapman test on direct review of federal constitutional error. So we know that's the test. The Wisconsin Supreme Court, in the Diaz case many years ago, essentially adopted the Chapman test and imported some concepts from the Strickland case to kind of flesh out the test, so that the test in Wisconsin, at least as it applies to federal constitutional error, as I understand it, is that the error must be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt and that it requires reversal if there is a reasonable possibility that the error contributed to the verdict, which means that if the error undermines confidence in the outcome of the case, reversal is appropriate. That, I think, is the standard that the Supreme Court reaffirmed in the Nader case. It is the standard that I think, because of the Chapman case and because Brecht says that's the standard that state courts use, that this court must use. But that isn't the standard that the Wisconsin Court of Appeals used.
Counsel, how do you get around? We have a .357 Magnum here, six shots, not automatic weapon. Six deliberate shots, if or at least more than one, since it's not automatic. I mean, that's pretty compelling evidence that there was some intent to commit the crime.
That's certainly an inference that the jury could fairly draw and rationally draw from the evidence in this case. I concede that. But it's certainly not the only evidence, and a reviewing court cannot sit as a jury. It cannot substitute its view of the evidence for reasonable views that the jury may have taken.
Okay, give me the reasonable view counter to what
sure.
I just said.
Sure. Patricia Weed told the police, well, first of all, she asked the police to help her husband. That is inconsistent with the notion that she wanted him dead. You wouldn't ask the police to go help somebody if you want the guy dead. I'm on my stopwatch.
That's not right, I don't think.
You should finish the...
Okay.
No, there was no...
Sorry, there was an error. You still have 5 minutes.
Okay. Secondly, she told the police repeatedly that she did not mean to kill him, that she wanted to scare him, but not to kill him. And she said that over and over and over. A jury would be entitled to believe that. And a jury would also be entitled to believe that, given what was obviously a distraught state of mind, that when she took the gun and pointed at her husband and meant to scare him, that without thinking, whether it was in a moment of a non-functioning brain or whatever, that she pulled the trigger, that her finger kept pulling the trigger, but that her mind at that point wasn't forming the intent to kill. Now, the trial judge in this case must have thought that that was a reasonable view of the evidence because he instructed the jury on the lesser included offense of first-degree reckless homicide. And he wouldn't have gotten to the point of instructing the jury on the lesser included unless he thought there was a reasonable view of the evidence that would permit acquittal of first-degree intentional homicide and conviction of a crime that did not require a specific intent to kill. So given that there is a factual scenario which is reasonable and which a jury could come to, allowing it to conclude that she didn't mean to kill him, the question is whether the introduction of evidence of unloading the gun has an impact or could have had an impact on the jury's reasoning. And obviously it could have. If the jury had been inclined up to the point at which the FOIA bringers testified to say, well, you know, I think she was obviously reckless, but I don't think she really intended to kill him. I believe her when she told the police I didn't mean to hurt him. The jury would have changed its mind pretty rapidly when it learned that she, in fact, loaded the gun, if that's what happened. So that is why I think the error contributes to the verdict and is not harmless.
Counsel.
Yes.
Ever seen the movie Chicago?
Is that the musical?
Yeah.
I did, yes.
See that scene where there were six women on murder's row and one of them stood up and said he did this and did that, so I fired two warning shots into his head. And then the other one gets up and says that he ran into my knife 10 times.
Yes.
This sounds eerily reminiscent of that.
Start singing.
You don't want to hear me singing. I don't think this is a song and dance, Your Honor. I think it is a reasonable view of the evidence that a jury could rationally draw. And that is what I think the Supreme Court in Nader emphasized, that you have to look at what the jury could rationally believe. And if the jury's rational view of the evidence could be affected by erroneously admitted evidence, and that could sway the verdict or have an impact on the verdict or, in this Court's parlance, undermine confidence in the verdict, it's not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
Counsel, if on the third issue, if there is a right to testify, and there is, it's a fundamental right,
yes,
and if it waiver of that right requires a personal colloquy or equivalent to a personal colloquy, what's the remedy for violation?
I would like the remedy to be reversal, because I think that the point of having that colloquy is to assure that at the time of the trial, the defendant knows she has the right to testify, understands that she has the right to testify, understands that it's her call, that her counsel can't make that for her. I'm not sure that in a post-trial hearing it is possible for a judge to say with any certainty what the defendant did or didn't understand at the time of trial. That's why it's important to have that colloquy at the time of trial, so that the defendant is told, this is your right, it's your personal right, here's what it means, you can testify or you cannot testify, tell me what your choice is. That way we have a record that we know protects the defendant's constitutional fundamental right to testify.
Trial judges make those kinds of retrospective decisions all the time. That's what a Miranda Goodchild hearing is all about, right?
I agree with that, and there are other cases in which courts have retroactively made those kinds of decisions.
And any number of decisions on ineffective assistance of counsel claims are made with that kind of hindsight.
True, although the right to counsel is fundamental. I'm not sure the right to effective counsel has been declared fundamental. I don't know if it is or not. But
to make those determinations about what somebody
knew. That's true. And even if the court looks then at the post-conviction hearing, I don't think the record, first of all, the trial judge didn't make any findings of historical fact at all. This court exercises a de novo review over the constitutional fact, which is, did she knowingly and voluntarily waive her right to testify? And I don't think that the record supports the trial judge's constitutional finding that she did. And again, I'm out of time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly. Sally Wellman, Assistant Attorney General of the Department of Justice, representing the state of Wisconsin.
May it please the Court, Assistant Attorney General Sally Wellman representing the state, which is the plaintiff respondent in this case. Let me start with the right to testify issue, since we ended with that. The state does not believe that there is a constitutional requirement of a colloquy or a personal waiver of the right to testify. There certainly is a constitutional right to testify. And if a defendant waives that right, his waiver has to be, or her waiver has to be, knowing, voluntary, and intelligent. But how that is demonstrated or shown and when it must be demonstrated on the record are two entirely separate questions. And I think it's very important that this Court keep that distinction clear, as it did in Klessig and in Bangert. In Klessig, which involved the waiver of the right to counsel, there was not an adequate colloquy at the time of trial. And this Court held that as its administrative and supervisory authority over the lower courts, it was going to demand a certain colloquy on the record. Prior to that time, it had not made that a requirement. The same thing is so in Bangert, which, of course, is the guilty plea rule. this court said there are no specific terms or words or advice or question and answer that the court, as a matter of constitutional right, has to go through. So if there's not an adequate colloquy in the trial court below, then we look at whether, in fact, the defendant did understand all the rights he was waiving. And that's an important distinction. I think the question here really is a matter of policy and administrative and supervisory authority, whether this court thinks that it's necessary or appropriate or would be better to have a mandated colloquy like we do in Klessig and Bangert, and then henceforth, once they've been told that, if a trial court forgets or fails to do so, and the defendant complains about that post-conviction, then we would remand for an evidentiary hearing, just like we do in Klessig and Bangert, and the state would bear the burden of showing by clear and convincing evidence based on all the evidence, including the post-conviction hearing, that the defendant did, in fact, knowing, voluntarily, and intelligently waive. Go ahead.
If I may, thank you.
Sure.
This is difficult for me, this issue of remedy of the fundamental right. And I look to the right to have a trial by jury, or the right to have a jury by 12 people. And our law, our decisions indicate that it is a fundamental right, the right to have a trial by jury. And it can only be waived by a colloquy on the record, and that if it is not waived by a colloquy on the record, the remedy is new trial. So what makes the right to testify, which is also a fundamental right under Rock, unlike the right to have a fundamental right to have a trial by jury, and more like Bangert? I have real difficulties drawing the line. We've said that it is a fundamental right to have a trial by jury. There must be a colloquy. So assist me.
Well, as I understand the underlying case law, the case that held that was Livingston. And, in fact, Livingston did not hold it as a matter of constitutional law. It said the statute requires that. And we're going to hold that because the statute requires an affirmative waiver, either orally or in writing by the defendant, if that of the right to a jury trial. If that doesn't happen, we're going to reverse, period. Now, it could have done what it did in Bangert, and it said, well, in Bangert, the statute is not as specific, so we're not going to enforce it in the same way.
The Court of Appeals not too recently, came down with a case of State versus Thornton. I'm not sure if you are familiar with it. Let me just comment on it briefly, and then if you're not familiar, then that's fine. But as I look at that case, which was decided November of this past year, so about 3 or 4 months, in that case, as I understand it, the Court of Appeals addressed the issue of the waiver of right to counsel in the appellate context and indicated that a criminal defendant may waive his or her right to counsel in a criminal trial proceedings provided the record reflects that the waiver is knowing, intelligently, and voluntarily made. And then they continue to describe, well, you know, for obvious reasons, we have difficulty doing a colloquy. So maybe we can get the necessary information on the record from the correspondence in the file. If not, we can remand it to the circuit court to do a personal colloquy. So why is the right to a counsel, which apparently demands a colloquy on the record, the right to a jury trial, which apparently demands a colloquy on the record, those fundamental rights, different than the right to be able to testify at trial which you're saying doesn't require colloquy on the record. Why is it different?
Well, I think there's two responses to that. The first is that if I am correctly recalling Thornton, Thornton isn't saying that it's required as a matter of constitutional right, that there be specific communications back and forth between the appellate court and the defendant and appellate lawyer. And that's what happened in Thornton is there were writings back and forth where the court would write and say, well, do you want this or do you want this, and answer, and he would answer, and the court said that was sufficient. But Flores made it very clear, which is this court's decision that predates Thornton, that there is no specific, in fact, we had urged the court to make appellate counsel file a specific statement that they'd explained everything, including no merits, to the defendant, and the defendant understood and was waiving, so we wouldn't have these post-trial problems. And the court said, no, the defendant's failure to do anything once he's been told, and we presume that counsel has done his job and told defendant, can be sufficient. And then if a defendant claims, no, he really didn't explain it, my attorney didn't, or I didn't understand, or I told him I wanted no merit and he didn't file it, then again we do the whole hearing procedure and the trial court makes findings of fact. Now, I don't recall if Thornton discussed Flores into what and what it said about it. So that may be clarified. I think a petition for review is pending in Thornton also, although I'm not positive. And I think what is different is I don't think that the Constitution requires a colloquy in any of those cases. And at this point, a statute doesn't require it. So that takes it out of the jury trial box. That's the difference there. In terms of whether it's a good practice and should be done, I think many trial courts do it now, and we have not seen complaints about that. I think the sticking point is that because you have the two rights that are flip sides of each other. The defendant has the right to testify or not to testify. When the defendant testifies, she's by definition giving up her right not to testify, and vice versa. And it's very, very much a matter of trial strategy. It's ultimately the defendant's call, but we want to be very careful that in advising defendants, a court doesn't unintentionally influence the defendant, who's already talked to counsel at length, and as in this case the facts prove, she wanted to testify at first, he told her she'd be a bad witness, explained why, she came to agree with him and said, okay, I won't testify. We don't want the trial court to somehow subtly influence her and make her think, gee, the court thinks I should testify, or the court's telling me my lawyer's wrong. Now, we're not saying that that happens when a trial court does advise, but I think we need to be very, very careful. And one of the concerns we have in this case is that although defense is asking this court to mandate a colloquy, the defense is not telling us exactly what that colloquy should say.
Am I correctly characterizing the state's position? And I get this in large part from assertions made on page 28 of your brief.
Okay, I'm there.
Let me start with the last full paragraph on that page and maybe work, or let me start from the very top, the very first sentence. The state certainly agrees that a colloquy would be helpful to protect the defendant's constitutional rights. In the rare case where a defense counsel does not explain, etc. I jump down then to the next paragraph. The state perceives that on the record colloquy and express determination that the defendant personally understands he has the right to testify and is voluntarily waiving that right would probably eliminate some untrue claims, etc. Next paragraph. From the state's perspective, a colloquy seems to be beneficial to the defense and the criminal justice system, and the practice seems to be well accepted and implemented in the circuit courts. This does not seem likely that a mandated as opposed to recommended colloquy policy would create significant additional burdens. It seems to me, with those scenes, that what you're saying is, look, it's already recommended in Wilson. No big deal. In fact, it makes sense to mandate it. Now, tell me if I'm wrong, as you're saying. But our concern is, what are the contours of what's said, and it has to be very carefully crafted. Am I correctly characterizing your position?
Yes, except you're leaving out one thing, which is also our position, and that is that in Albright, this court already declined to mandate a colloquy. The federal courts have declined, and the vast majority of state courts have declined to, for this very reason of being concerned that it will interfere with and somehow influence the defendant's decision.
Remind me, was Albright prior to Rock?
Yes.
So Albright was did not consider this right a fundamental right, where Rock did.
Right, but it could have required a colloquy in its administrative and supervisory authority anyway.
Unlikely, though, if it says it's not a fundamental right, why are we going to do a colloquy?
Yeah, I guess I can't answer that. So, I mean, I guess what I'm saying is, you know, we don't think it would be a big problem if the court mandated it in terms of it would help make records from the appellate lawyer's standpoint. That's great. But we do think that other concerns are significant, and this coming up in a one-case posture where, understandably, from her own interest, the defendant isn't looking to kind of outline the law for everybody in the future. She's saying, I didn't get a colloquy. I wanted a colloquy. I should get a new trial. We're reluctant to have the court do it, somewhat reluctant to have the court do it, when there are no you know, the bench book doesn't have any recommended colloquy. SM 32, which is on guilty plea, somewhat to my surprise, I guess I just assumed that among the constitutional rights the trial court tells defendants about when they plead guilty and contained in SM 32 would be the right to testify, and that's not in there. So we're just recommending that it might be wiser so that all of the defense positions and all the positions of those who have declined to impose colloquies before, that could be fully aired out in either the rulemaking process or perhaps the jury instructions committee could be asked to draft one as a starting point.
Well, if we do that, what's the next issue that comes before us, whether or not when a defendant gets on the witness stand to testify that they must be told that they have a right not to testify?
Well, that's a very good question. That had not occurred to me until one of my colleagues asked me that. And, you know, I have to admit, I don't remember seeing that in any records when defendants have testified, although logically, it's a logical extension of this. Now, it may be that there are some. Not that many defendants testify, and unfortunately, you know, for all the wonderful legal research tools we have, we don't have any way to go back and search records. In other cases, we've not seen an issue, to my knowledge, where a defendant has claimed that, although we may now.
Once you get it into the record, it becomes an issue. I was thinking as a trial judge where the, and this is an actual thing, where in the closing argument, the prosecution said, of course, you noticed that the defendant did not take the stand. And of course, what happened was a mistrial, which would be because you cannot comment on that. So the more you get into this, the more I think that there's a potential for problems in that area. So,
well, we certainly are concerned, one, that we do. I think someone needs to decide. If we're going to require trial courts to do it and say that a record without it on its face, if it's challenged, won't be good enough and you'll have to do this classic Bangert hearing, then I think we owe it, frankly, to the trial court judges to tell them, do you have to tell them that you have the right both to silence and to testify? And if you want to testify, nobody can stop you. If you don't want to testify, nobody can make you. You should make this decision after consulting with your attorney. Is this really your decision? Now, there's at least one court, and it's in my brief, I don't recall if it was Hawaii, that has recommended this. We're also concerned, however, that courts not go as far, that the colloquy that would be mandated not go as far as some courts in other states. The few that have mandated it, there are a couple, and I discussed this in my brief, where they said, well, the trial court should warn the defendant that there are some downsides or disadvantages to testifying, like if you have prior convictions, they might come in to impeach you. And, you know, there are so many factors that go into that, whether any particular prior conviction would be used to impeach, whether, for example, suppose we had a prior statement from the defendant that had been excluded on Miranda grounds. Couldn't come in the state's case in chief, but it was voluntary, so if the defendant got up and told a story different, the state could then put that in. Should the trial court tell the defendant about that? Maybe the trial court doesn't even know. If the state wisely decided not to try to use the evidence in the first place, there wouldn't have been a Miranda Goodchild hearing. So
Ms.
it just
Wellman,
it gets complicated.
Has our Court of Appeals a number of years ago told trial judges that it's a good idea to make a record when a defendant is not testifying?
It did recommend it in Wilson and I believe again in Simpson. And, you know, we don't have a...
Well, this wouldn't be something startling or a major change for trial judges around the state, would it?
It wouldn't be, but the caveat is in Wilson they simply said, you know, you should do something on the record to make sure the defendant knows it's his right and understands it and that, you know, it's his choice. They didn't go into, do you also need to tell him about the right to silence?
But what about if you just say to the defendant, has counsel advised you of your right to remain silent and your right to testify and explain these rights to you?
That would certainly be a starting point, but I think you'd also want to say, and do you understand that it's your decision if we're going to go this route at all?
So then we just say two things. One, has counsel done it? Yes, counsel. Yes, the defendant. Not in the presence of the jury.
Right, so. Right.
And then you say, do you understand it? What's the matter with that?
I don't think there's anything the matter with it.
You don't think it's fully enough? At least if the defendant doesn't dig it, you'd think the defendant would say, I'm
yeah.
not sure I understand that, and at which
right.
point the judge says, why don't we have a recess?
Right.
Discuss this.
Yeah. You know, and I think that probably is adequate if the court is going to mandate something. At least spell out that you think it's a good idea for them to tell them both about the right to silence and the right to testify.
In this case, if the defendant had testified, wouldn't she have had to explain how the gun that was usually kept in a table right inside the bedroom, how that gun got in her hand?
Well, I would think so. She did testify at the post-conviction hearing. Well, let me back up. Her counsel testified at the post-conviction hearing that she would not be able to testify as to whether she had to load it or not because she told him she didn't remember getting the gun. And she had said that to the police, too, although at an earlier point she had remembered going and getting the gun. On cross-examination, she says, I went and got the gun hours before I went in the bedroom. I sat with it. I sat with my wedding photos on my lap. And, you know, so I don't know what her testimony would be at trial. Obviously, her counsel was concerned about the numerous inconsistent stories that she had given already.
I think what I'm really getting at is you run over a whole bunch of things like prior inconsistent statements and statements that weren't used and all sorts of things. But I mean, basically, a defendant who takes the stand can be subject to very extensive cross-examination.
Right. Right. And that's another reason. I mean, we rely on defense counsel, trial counsel, to have had this discussion with the defendant and tell the defendant all the ups and downs and all the tough questions that they're not going to be able to answer and not going to be able to explain away.
Counsel, if the court decides this afternoon that there should be a colloquy, I mean, what do we say about cross-examination and all of these subtleties?
I think you have to leave those alone. I think you really have to leave that to trial counsel because once you start, where do you stop? And the risk is if you tell, and the real problem I have with some, those other states that I mentioned in my brief where they tell them, you know, you could be impeached by prior conviction. If that's all you tell them, it suggests to them that that's the only risk, or it could. And that would be misleading. So sometimes a little information is worse than no information from that standpoint.
Isn't there a distinction between the scope of a right and the strategy involved? In other words, the individual strategies with regard to that are often made by attorneys in terms of trial strategies is something different than what the scope of the right involves. I think sometimes that kind of distinction is made in terms of professional responsibility. Our jurisprudence that the attorney can make the strategies, but it's the client who has the right to define the scope. Does that come into play at all here?
Well, I don't think so in this case, although conceivably it could and did in one of the cases we cited where the trial counsel admitted, I never told him he had the right to testify, and I just didn't call him, and it was my unilateral decision because I thought he'd be a bad witness. And that would be clearly wrong if that happened. Unlike, and he's, you know, he had good strategic reasons for doing that, but that wouldn't be good enough in this situation. Unlike a situation, for example, where counsel says, well, I didn't call X witness, and I have these good strategic reasons, that we would not interfere with. If that's, I'm not sure if I'm getting at what you were getting at. I do just want to make it really clear, however, that if this court would mandate a colloquy, then you should do as you did in Klesic and Banger and say in cases henceforth where there is not a colloquy or not adequate, depending on what you set forth as adequate, it doesn't mean automatic reversal. It means we have a hearing like we do in Klesic and Banger. Now, in this particular case, it wouldn't be necessary to remand for a hearing because we had the hearing on the front end, and the trial court made a factual finding. He said, I'm relying on defense counsel's testimony, which was the exact opposite of the defendant. The defendant was saying, he told me I had the right to testify, but he didn't tell me it was my choice, and I didn't understand it was my choice, and I told him I want to testify, and he wouldn't let me. Trial counsel said, no, I told her it was her right. I recommended that she not and all the reasons. She never told me on the day of trial, I want to testify. If she had, I would have put her on. And that's what I've done in other cases. The trial court said he was relying on trial counsel's testimony. I don't see how you can see that as anything but a credibility determination. And the trial court also relied on the fact that the very next day, after the jury came back with the verdict on guilt, the defendant came into court and waived her right to a jury trial for the insanity phase. And there was an excellent record made. It was very clear she understood, this is my right. My counsel doesn't agree with me. He's recommending that I not do this. I want to do it anyway. And so the suggestion that she was too emotionally upset or under too many medications to understand her rights and implement them is not supported by the record.
Ms. Wellman, how about that harmless error rule? You want to whiff and sinnoh that one for us?
Sure.
That's going to be forever.
That is going to be forever. I know it is.
Sorry, I couldn't help it.
That's okay. I deserve it. Let me just start with the Court of Appeals decision, which cited the Givens case. And I didn't talk about it in my brief. I already was over length and cut some things. But unfortunately, and I don't mean by that to be dumping on the Court of Appeals or saying we don't agree with them. It's just that it's a question.
Don't, do you?
I do not. It's just a question of law, so it doesn't really matter what the Court of Appeals did.
No, but you don't agree with them. Why?
No, I mean, I don't agree that they erred.
Okay, do you agree that they should have cited Givens?
I think Givens is adequate. It's just a little too much shorthand. I mean, I think if you read Givens itself, as opposed to how defense characterize it, Givens says we look at the other evidence unaffected and uninfluenced by the error. And I think that means we look at whether it contributed. I mean, I think it's just a different way of saying it.
I'm sorry, but didn't Givens do a sufficiency of the evidence rule?
We don't read it that way, no.
Well, a heading says sufficiency of the evidence. The sufficiency of the evidence. Givens next argues that there was insufficient evidence to convict him.
That might have been a standalone argument. I don't think that's a harmless error argument, but I don't have it in front of me.
No. The whole Givens thing is sufficiency of the evidence. It doesn't mention harmless error, unless there's another piece that I haven't looked at.
No,
I don't think it is.
No, it does. It's at 217 with second. I don't remember the
page. I'm looking at 217 with second.
Let's see. The Court of Appeals cites it at Appendix 103. They say 217 with second at 193.
Okay. I'll look at 193. Go ahead.
Which I believe was their harmless error argument.
All right.
The Court of Appeals also relied on Dias, which preceded Harvey. It's our position that this Court, of course,
just so the record's clear, you are relying in your brief on Harvey, are you not?
Yes. We believe Harvey correctly states the test and that it's just a different way of saying the same test as Chapman. We don't think they're two different tests. We don't think one is weaker or stronger than the other. I think it's just two ways of saying the same thing. And in both cases, under Chapman, you look at, can the court say beyond a reasonable doubt that the error did not contribute to the verdict? And in Nader, you say, is it clear beyond a reasonable doubt that a rational jury would have convicted absent the error? In both cases, you have to look at both pieces. You have to look at what was the character and nature of the erroneous, in this case, erroneously admitted evidence, and how did that play into the entire case, the context of the defense, the state's case, the strength. So it really, I think it's not fair to say that all that either test does, that the Nader-Harvey test does, is look at the other evidence. And if it was, would have sufficed, that's good enough. Let's take, for example, a case where you have a defendant's confession was improperly admitted. And you have some other evidence. You maybe have some eyewitness testimony. You have some property he had that might or might not have been the stolen property. You've got some other circumstantial evidence. But the primary evidence was that confession. I think most courts would say it's very difficult to say a confession didn't influence the jury or contribute to the verdict because juries give that a lot of weight. Suppose, on the other hand, you have four confessions, all of them identical. Three of them were Mirandized, one of them wasn't. All four of them come in. The appellate court says, no, the fourth one shouldn't have come in. It's hard to imagine, given that you had three other identical confessions, that that one influenced the verdict. So I think that's the nature of looking at the two playing together.
I think that's a good explanation. So let's take your first one where you got the confession and you got really strong evidence other than the confession, too. Mm-hmm. Okay? As you said, eyewitness, et cetera. So if you take the concept that when a reviewing court determines that it is clear beyond a reasonable doubt that a rational jury would have found the defendant guilty absent the error. That's the Harvey test, right?
Mm-hmm.
So absent that, even if you did not have a confession in there, which was error, that there was very strong evidence beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant is guilty. Do you let that, what is it, harmless error or not harmless error?
I think if all
that's the acid test, but
I think if all you're saying is there was other sufficient evidence, they would have convicted
anyway.
No,
well, that's why I started with sufficient evidence. I'm saying that you can say, looking at all the evidence, absent the error, the reviewing court, and I'm looking at your brief at the mm-hmm. bottom of 12, the reviewing court determines that it is clear beyond a reasonable doubt that a rational jury would have had the defendant, would have found the defendant guilty. So looking at all the other evidence without the confession, and the confession had never been introduced, a rational jury would have found him guilty. Now, we all agree that the confession does play a part, an important part, right?
Right, so in our hypothetical.
That's right, in your hypothetical, which is the same hypothetical I thought of.
Well, except I thought my evidence was kind of weak because eyewitness evidence
I know,
was
kind of weak. Only for you and maybe people who know, but for a jury, eyewitness evidence is it. So what do you do under Harvey? I know what you do under Chapman. Under mm-hmm. Chapman, as you said, that confession would have had an effect on the jury verdict. Doesn't mean it would have necessarily changed it. But under Harvey, I don't think that's true. But that's why I'm asking you, because you make them absolutely equivalent.
And I think they are, because I'm reading Harvey to mean when you say absent the evidence, you're saying that erroneous evidence didn't make a difference. And isn't that the same thing as looking at whether it contributed to the verdict?
Only about the confession case. I want you to decide that on harmless error under Harvey and under Chapman.
I think it would be difficult under Harvey for a court to conclude beyond a reasonable doubt that the confession would, that the jury would have come back with the same verdict. It's not could, it's would. A rational jury would have. Beyond a reasonable doubt, I think that looking at that as a flip side of Chapman, you couldn't say that any more than you can say beyond a reasonable doubt it didn't contribute to the verdict. Probably didn't. pretty comfortable that it didn't? Maybe, but beyond a reasonable doubt?
Possibly did.
Possibly?
Possibly it did. So that's your test,
yes.
Possibly.
No, my test is Chapman and Nader, which I think are not flip sides, but alternative ways of phrasing the same test.
And doesn't it depend on the nature of the defense and what's in the confession? I mean, there are confessions and there are confessions.
Right,
I mean,
that's true,
there are confessions
too.
Where the defendant places himself at the scene but says, I did nothing.
Right.
There are confessions where the defendant places himself at the scene, says, I pulled the trigger, but I didn't mean to.
Right.
And there are cases where the confession comes in the state's case in chief and the defendant testifies. You know, so
right. So it wouldn't be every confession across the board. I was sort of assuming that, sort of like your dead confession, like you've totally, prevented yourself from having any defense in light of your confession. But obviously, that's not our case. But I think, we do rely on our brief then for what the harmless error application is in this particular case. If there are no...
What about, was there error?
No, we don't think it was error. We don't think it violated the Confrontation Clause, and it was admissible either as residual or under the Statement of Recent Perception, because if we remember what the Statement of Recent Perception is, it's sort of like the first cousin to an excited utterance. It's just that you may not have the immediacy of it. And
how recent is this recent perception here?
Well, his perception of the...
When did the event occur?
Well, the event of taking the bullets out of the gun, we don't know.
So how can you say it's recent? Recent relative to what? Recent relative to I don't know when.
Well, there's two parts of the statement. He's saying that's why, and that part was very recent. He was responding to his wife's behavior that night.
I'll tell you, I see a couple of problems with your argument, and I'd like you to respond. Number one is just what I said. Statement of recent perception, by definition, requires some relation. Recent to what? Here we don't know when the event occurred. It could have occurred on September 4th, 8 days before the statement is made. Is that recent?
Well, I think we can infer that to the extent that he was talking about the suicide attempt, which is what
the September 4th date is I'm talking
yes.
about. Yeah.
She didn't get out of the hospital until September 9th, so she didn't have access to the gun at home again until September 9th. He made the statement on the 12th. So I think it's reasonable to infer, although we don't know for sure because he didn't say that, that that is sufficiently recent. That's a reasonable scenario.
But
it's only a foundation. I mean, it doesn't have to be proof, by clear and convincing evidence.
In this very case, the trial court on an evidentiary ruling opined that a hearsay statement made 2 days after the shooting was too remote in time.
And I don't recall exactly what that statement was and whether it was offered under statement of recent perception. My recollection is that it wasn't offered the same exception.
My logical extension is if 2 days is too remote in time, how can whatever it is, 3 days or 8 days or when she was experiencing depression before the suicide, whatever the trigger date is, it just seems kind of...
We don't know for sure on recency, which is another reason why we rely on the residual, because that is more similar to a statement of a child victim in the sense that you only have two witnesses and one of them can't testify. Here in this case, only two people know what happened that night, and one of them's dead.
Does it cause you pause that the residual requires sufficient indicia of reliability, but the feds have refused to adopt this recent perception rule of evidence because they find it too unreliable?
No, because I just think that's an erroneous judgment call on their part.
Okay.
Ms. Wellman, what's the difference between the sufficiency of the evidence test and the harmless error test?
Oh, let me see if I can remember the sufficiency.
I'll read it to you
okay.
from Jackson v. Virginia.
Okay.
The evidence is sufficient to convict if, quote, after viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the prosecution, any rational trier of fact could have found the essential elements of the crime beyond a reasonable doubt. I'm going to read the Harvey-Nader test.
Okay.
An error is harmless if it is clear beyond a reasonable doubt that a rational jury would have found the defendant guilty absent the error.
Well, there's two primary differences. The first one is the sufficiency evidence deliberately looks at the evidence in the light most favorable to the conviction. And we don't do that with harmless error.
All right.
And the second is the difference between could and would, which I think is a significant difference, because in Harvey, Nader, we're not saying, could a jury have convicted anyway? I think could is a much looser, less protective test than we believe beyond a reasonable doubt that a rational jury would have.
Would you say that under the harmless error, every jury would have found the defendant guilty?
I'm reluctant to say that because every jury as opposed to a rational jury.
Well,
don't
you have to assume that if every jury is rational, every jury would have found this guilty beyond reasonable doubt? If it's an irrational jury, we're not interested in
mm-hmm.
it. But every rational jury would have found the defendant guilty absent the error.
I guess I'm not sure I know what significance saying every does. And maybe it's not significant, but off the top of my head, that's a little different than the Harvey formulation. But I think you also have to look at, I mean, you're completely ignoring the impact of the improper evidence when the way we're looking at it now, and that's not what I read Harvey to be saying. I know we disagree on that.
No. You don't read Harvey to say to ignore the
right. Harvey does not tell us to ignore the impact of the improperly admitted evidence. And
it says would have found the defendant guilty absent the error.
Right, and absent the error to mean, I read that to mean we're saying it didn't make any difference, i.e. it didn't contribute to the verdict. It's not just we erase it as if it never happened, because then I don't think you can say it's the equivalent of Chapman. And they clearly thought they were saying the same thing. They were saying the same thing. They said they're saying the same thing. So
that's the point. So you have to look at the error.
You absolutely have to look at the error.
You have to look to see if it influenced the verdict.
Right.
Even if there's tremendous amount of evidence aside from the erroneous.
Right. And I think contribute means did it make a difference? Do we think it made a difference beyond a reasonable doubt? You know, are we convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that it didn't make a difference? I'm used to phrasing it in the negative, but and here, I mean, you know, we don't know. The prosecutor even said during closing argument, we don't know if the gun was loaded or not. He just wanted her statement that it was always kept loaded not to go uncontradicted. And it doesn't really matter for intent when she shot him 6 times while he's lying in bed, helpless. That's when we look at her intent, not her intent when she got it out of the drawer. Who knows what she thought then? But when she's pointing that gun and firing 6 times, that's the intent that's critical.
But part of your brief, this bothered me. It seemed to me you thought this evidence was critical.
Oh, I don't think we ever thought it was critical. And I think when we were talking about it being necessary in the terms of the confrontation
yes.
clause, by necessary, and obviously I didn't articulate this very well in the brief, by necessary we didn't mean that it's critical to the case as a whole. We meant it's necessary in the sense that if we don't use the hearsay, we have no evidence to rebut her story.
Well,
because there is no
significant to the state if you don't have this to rebut her story?
It depends on how important that part of her story is. And what we're ultimately saying is whether the gun was loaded, whether she took a gun that she believed was loaded and went in and fired it 6 times at her husband in bed, or whether she had to stop and load it, those can both be equally indicative of intent. So in the long run, in light of the entire picture, it's not significant to the verdict because it's not that significant to intent.
That's the whole point of Chicago.
I've got to see that movie. When I stop having oral arguments and have time to go to the movies, I've got to see that one.
Back into my knife. 7, 10 times. First time, maybe. I shot off warning shots. The first time, maybe. But 2 warning shots into his head.
Right. And just one more.
It's other acts evidence, Ms. Lomi.
Pardon me?
It's other acts evidence.
Oh, other acts evidence. I do just want to say in this case, though, that one statement of fact that I think is incomplete is when the officer said, "I only saw one wound in the arm," he said from where he was laying, where the defendant or the victim was laying and where the officer was standing. And then a later officer described how he'd fallen off the bed and the sheets were all still wrapped around him and between his legs and stuff. So it doesn't mean that that's all that was the wounds that she might have known he had, because she was right there shooting into the bed, into him in the bed.
Thank you, Ms. Roman. Mr. Kelly?
Thank you, I think we can debate whether the Nader case is intended or did intend to change the Chapman standard of harmless error. But I think if you read the entire Nader case, you see that the Supreme Court went out of its way to say Chapman is the test. I don't think it changed it at all. I'm not sure what Harvey means, because if you read the concurring opinions and the dissenting opinions, they characterize the majority opinion in a different way. I do know that Chapman is the test, because the Supreme Court has told us that's the test that state courts apply in direct review. And the Chapman test was not applied by the Court of Appeals in this case. The Court of Appeals didn't ask, did the evidence of loading the gun have an influence, or could it have had an influence on the verdict? The Court of Appeals said, well, look at all this other evidence that's out there. And that's not acceptable under Chapman or under Nader. Nader specifically cautions that reviewing courts, quote, as Justice Traynor put it, should not become, in effect, a second jury to determine whether the defendant is guilty. Rather, a court in typical appellate court fashion asks whether the record contains evidence that could rationally lead to a contrary finding. In this case, there is evidence that could rationally allow a jury to determine that Patricia Weed did not intend to kill her husband. She said that. She didn't shoot him in the heart or shoot him in the head or shoot him in a place that was obviously going to kill him. She didn't realize that he was dead. At least that's an inference that can reasonably be drawn from her behavior afterwards. And she specifically told the police time and time again, I didn't mean to hurt him. That would allow a jury.
I find that when I look at page 17 of your opposing counsel's brief, in very vivid terms, it goes through that there were six bullets in the gun. I have a .357, I'm aware, and you have to pull the trigger every time, and at least four, if not all six, hit this the victim, and it, in very graphic style, discusses exactly where the bullets hit the victim. And as I read this, it's hard to say that this was not, you know, this was each time you have to pull that hammer back or pull the trigger, and they're all six bullets were fired in the gun. So, I mean, that's what was there as far as the evidence on intent.
That is some of the evidence on intent, and that allows an inference to be drawn that she intended to kill him. But it's not the only evidence of intent. There is also evidence that she did not intend to kill him. That evidence comes from her own words and from her actions after the police arrived. So a jury had a choice to make. It could decide, I believe she didn't intend to kill her. She acted irrationally. She acted recklessly. But she never formed the specific intent to kill. I believe what she told the police. That is something a jury could rationally have believed after listening to the evidence in this case.
Based on the location of these gunshot wounds?
Based on everything.
I don't want to repeat with the children in the
room.
Well,
I know, but it's not.
Multiple gunshot wounds in multiple parts of the body.
Correct. But again, that is part of the evidence. It's not the whole story. And this court doesn't sit in the jury room listening to, or in the courtroom, listening to all the witnesses testify. That's the jury's job. And the jury also heard contradictory evidence. They heard that Patricia Weed said, I didn't intend to kill him, that she was distraught, that she was sad, that she was asking for somebody to help her husband. That's not consistent with somebody who wants to kill the man. A jury then could decide, based on what they heard, that in fact she may have acted recklessly and may have committed the crime of reckless homicide, but didn't mean to kill him. And if a jury can rationally come to that conclusion, this Court can't second-guess the jury and decide, well, here's how the jury would have decided this case if there hadn't been an error. The Court has to ask, would that view of the evidence, which is consistent with lack of intent, be negated or be influenced by the improperly admitted evidence? And clearly it does.
The allegedly improperly admitted evidence consists of the out-of-court statement that the gun was unloaded, basically, right?
Right.
Which leads to the inference
that she loaded the gun.
That she loaded the gun, which goes not to the intent necessarily that she had at the moment she pulled the trigger, but to whether she engaged in any preparation or planning for this assault.
Which would certainly go to intent.
Right.
It isn't consistent with an intent to frighten him, which is what she told the police was her intent, to load the gun. You don't have to load a gun to frighten somebody with a gun.
But we know it was loaded. So the only question is whether she loaded it or whether
the statement that I unloaded the gun is unreliable and, in fact, wasn't true, which is why it shouldn't have been admitted in the first place.
But does it make any difference? That's what
it does make a difference, because if the jury was thinking prior to hearing that testimony, you know, I don't believe she intended to kill him, and then hears that I think she intended to frighten him but not kill him, but then hears that she loaded the gun, that conclusion becomes a whole lot less likely, because you don't load a gun if you want to frighten somebody.
Statement that I didn't intend to kill him, is that hearsay?
It probably would be hearsay, but it was introduced by the state against a party opponent, so it comes into an exception to the hearsay rule because of that.
But could the state have prevented that information from coming in?
The state introduced that information.
But, I mean, could it have prevented the information from?
If it had not introduced it and the defense wanted to put it in, probably, yeah. Red light again. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly, and thank you, Ms. Wellman, for your arguments in this case. And that ends our hearing on 01-1476-CR, State v. Patricia Weed. And we are recess until, I think it's next Tuesday at 9 o'clock.